Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we have got a treat for you today. Last time we told you we would be back, this time with a murder mystery from the development of the motion picture technology history. And today, our friend Scott Benjamin is joining us on the show.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people keep turning up dead in the history of the motion picture. So we thought we'd bring in somebody extra to help us out with the heavy lifting on this one.
Scott loves murder, and he's really great at talking about it. And I think it's going to be so much fun. So let's go right to our talk with Scott. Hey, so if you have been listening to this show for a while, and if you have made it to the little coda we tend to do at the end of every episode when we do our outro music, you've probably heard us mention Scott Benjamin, who helps with research on this show, and we have got such a treat for you. Scott Benjamin is joining us in studio today. Scott, it is a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
What should people know about you?
Well, I've been around here for a long time. I've been a podcaster with How Stuff Works originally for about 11 years now. Mm-hmm. I've taken the last couple of years off air, I guess, as I do research and writing for some other shows and some true crime stuff. In fact, I've got an all-new true crime podcast coming out pretty soon of my own. I can't really give you too many more details about it right now, but it's on its way.
But this is key to why we're having you on here now, because you've been helping us with the invention research, and then suddenly we ran across a little bit of true crime, or potentially true crime, or at least a mystery that's kind of embedded in the research for the invention of the motion picture.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought this was just a little bit too juicy to let it go, you know, without investigating this just a little bit more. And to be honest with you, it's about 129-year-old cold case now.
Wow.
So I don't think we're going to, solving anything.
We'll
today.
Solve it today, Scott.
I don't think so, but we could try at least. We can at least, let people know what's happening and let them investigate it for themselves and see what they think, because there's a few theories about what happened. All right, so here's what's going on. We tend to credit the invention of the motion picture camera to either Edison or the Lumiere brothers. Mm-hmm. And, we've got know the history behind that and the timing. It's all kind of strange timing. It all ties in very, very closely. Well, it appears that there was somebody that was filming scenes long time prior to that, 6-7 years prior to that.
Yes.
In 1888. And the earliest film that we have on record, anything that remains still, is from 1888, October 14th, 1888, as a matter of fact. We know the date because of a specific reason I'll tell you in a minute, but it's called the Roundhay Garden Scene. Mm-hmm. And that was shot by a man named Louis Le Prince. And Louis Le Prince, of course, French-born inventor. He had a lot of other things that he had developed, but a lot of them had to do with cinematography, the early days of cinematography. Mm-hmm. He filmed this scene. It's just like 2.1 seconds, I think, very quick, but it does show motion. And he was using, you know, a type of film that was the early days of film. It was paper-backed, and yeah. You know, it had a very complex way of getting this, you know, down and captured.
Now, this one, the Roundhay Garden Scene, is this before the celluloid film?
It is just before the celluloid film.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So that was just after this. He had not yet really quite kind of experimented with that yet. They know the date of this film because specifically 10 days later, one of the people that appeared in the film died. So it was like, you know, this is filmed on October 14th, but on October 24th, his mother-in-law, who was shown in the film, passed away. So they know specifically that it was prior to this date in 1888. It's provable by that. He did another scene that was like, I think it was a traffic crossing Leeds Bridge in 1888 as well. And there's a few other early films that have survived. But they're all from right in this time frame. The stuff from Edison and from the Lumiere brothers are in, you know, the early 1890s.
Yeah.
And then the patents came later, but that's part of the story that we're getting to here. You know, the patents.
Right. So we know that Edison was very much like a patent hawk, or is that the right word?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a little bit of over-demonization of Edison that maybe goes on the internet today. A few years back, what was it? There was some like popular comic strip where it was basically like, Tesla's great, Edison sucks.
Mm-hmm. Which of course it's probably a flawed idea to really go all in on either individual as being, you know, this angelic figure of invention or this demonic adversary.
Yeah, maybe actually it oversells Tesla instead of underselling Edison.
Yeah, but, well, you know, one of the problems, I guess, is that Edison had a huge laboratory that he worked in, mm-hmm. where he employed many, many inventors. And then, of course, anything that was invented under that umbrella, he would then take the credit for it. He would
right.
say, you know, this is Edison's invention. It's just right. like any other major corporation does now. The automotive companies do it all the time. You know, people invent features, functions, you know, parts, components, and yeah, they may get the patent, but, you know, I don't know, Ford or GM owns that product. They own the patent. They get the royalties from all that.
Well, this is something we've seen over and over again, just looking at the history of photography and now the motion picture, is that, you know, we want to think about the inventor as this individual that's just out there figuring out stuff on their own, and a lot of inventors do fall into that category. But increasingly, the closer you get into the modern era, the more you see this industrialization of invention, the corporate use of invention, and so you know, Edison is just a part of that growing trend. I mean, we already talked about Kodak on the show.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to think of inventors as Victor Frankenstein, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, the independent scientist working on a problem in solitude with their own mad genius. But more often, it's true that inventors need to be part of a system that's like providing infrastructure that makes their invention possible at the same time that they're working on the invention. And the movie camera is a perfect example of this because you couldn't really have the kinds of movie cameras that even Edison's people came up with, like William Dixon came up with, until you had celluloid film. And that was what, you know, other people were working on.
What would Frankenstein have been like, the novel, had it been Frankenstein Inc.
that right, yeah.
created the monster?
Yeah, Edison's like, you know, he gets one of his little lab assistants, like, oh, resurrect the dead, you know, and then I'll get the patent.
Yeah, this stuff is happening on separate continents as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just one of those times in history where, you know, they're working on the same thing hundreds, if not thousands of miles apart, mm-hmm. and they don't quite know it yet. They don't – each doesn't know what the other one's doing right at that moment unless, you know, there's some talk within the community of scientists, you know, of inventors, of what they're working on. And likely they would have kept that pretty, you know, close to the vest. They wouldn't have really said, hey, I'm working on this new camera, and here's – in fact, here's a drawing of how it works. Why don't you take that back to your lab and see if you can perfect that? No, it doesn't work that way. They keep them really, really tight until – of course, the goal is the patent, of course, to make the royalties from this invention. And apparently – it looks like Le Prince beat Edison to the to the mark there on the one.
So he made all the money, right?
No. No. Didn't make any money on it. In fact, I guess maybe we should jump right into the story here at this point, right?
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah. Tell us about the mystery, Scott.
All right. So, he's working on all the stuff. He actually successfully films these scenes, the Roundhay Garden scene, the traffic crossing Leeds Bridge, et cetera. And he's got this device. It's a single lens camera. Mm-hmm. And this is an improvement over a camera that he had just prior to that, which was like a 16 lens camera that shot. It was actually two banks of eight lenses, I think, that would quickly take images and then you could put those together and then show them in rapid succession and make a moving image out of them. This is a single lens camera that would record continuous motion.
Right. And, so this requires less laborious editing?
Yes. Yes, exactly right. And again, this is the old paper-backed film at this point. It's not the celluloid at this point. But he has this invention. He's ready to he's finally after, showing it to friends and family and, projecting these on screens in his laboratory or wherever, these private showings. He's ready to go to the public with this, to show it publicly and then file for a patent in New York City here in the United States. And this is all going to happen in October of 1890. Mm-hmm. That's when it's supposed to happen. And so prior to that, he's still kind of touring around and he's got his family trying to get things together in New York City, trying to get things like a place to do this, a proper venue, et cetera. And they're working on that and they've got it. He's still in France and he makes a trip to see his brother, which is expected at this point because I guess his mother had just passed just prior to this. So his brother is in charge of the estate and kind of breaking up the estate and, the will, I guess, executing the will. So he makes a trip to Dijon, France, and he is spends like 3 days with his brother, and who knows, what's going on there, whether it's, they're talking about finances or whatever. I'm sure there's a lot to discuss at that point. But then his brother takes him to the train platform, the train station there in town in Dijon, and it's a Dijon to Paris express train. So it's not going to stop anywhere. It's going to go straight from there right to Paris, and he's back where he has to be. And then I think he's going to head to England and then to New York for this, the showing, this patent awarding or whatever. His brother says that he put him on the train, on the platform, and that's the last anybody ever saw of Le Prince. He just disappears somewhere in between Dijon and Paris.
On a nonstop train.
On a nonstop train, he completely disappears and his luggage disappears. There's no paper record of him being on the train, really. Other than his brother's word that he put him on the train, no one can remember seeing him on the train. Like, he didn't share a cabin with anybody or anything like that. And this is a pretty notable guy. And aside from that, the guy was 6'4". Uh-huh. So he kind of stands out.
He's a tall, thin guy. Yeah, he would stand out
today. Yeah, he would. He's a tall guy. I don't know how well known he was at that point, if anybody could really recognize him. I don't think that he was. But there's really no sighting of him on the train itself and certainly not in Paris when it arrived.
So obviously that seems suspicious, like that people don't normally disappear from trains.
No.
But so the question would be, are there any reasons people had to suspect foul play related to his invention other than just the fact that he was about to debut a hotly contested invention for which people would be competing for patents?
Well, the timing is extremely convenient for anybody else who might be working on a similar invention. Right? Uh-huh. I mean, so think about who that might be and we'll talk about them in just a moment. But all of this is going down on September 16th of 1890. He's, 49 years old at this point. And again, just 2 months later, or even 1 month later, I believe, he was supposed to be in New York to debut this. And this would have clearly it would have revolutionized the industry. I mean, it was something that was it was going to make him a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it.
All right. So he vanishes. But then what's the follow-up? Who's looking for him here?
Well, of course there's going to be an investigation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, his brother's word is that, you know, he put him on this train and now he's just suddenly gone into thin air, right? So Scotland Yard is on the case. And you would think Scotland Yard would do a decent, you know, examination of what's going on here, an investigation. The French police are also looking, and his family, of course, is searching for him as well, in addition to the other two agencies. So I don't know who they hired or how they went about that, the family themselves, but you've got three separate groups looking for him for years, really. I mean, they're trying to track him down, trying to figure out exactly what happened, because again, it doesn't just happen like this. So, it's just a real strange occurrence.
So if he disappeared, could you tell initially what the predominant theory was? Like at the time, did they think he was dead or did they think he had run off or what?
You know, I don't know if there was a predominant theory at that time. I think there were just so many different thoughts going through everybody's head, like what could have happened to this guy? You know, there's a lot of these came up later in time. I mean, some of them are like, you know, discussed in the 1960s, you know, so we're still talking about this guy 75 plus years later with a new theory about what might have happened. But there are three or four main theories that have been tossed around for the last 129 years.
Now, the more recent theories are going to, you know, pertain to our modern interpretations and really why we remember this guy.
Sure.
But at the time, I'm thinking, like, surely they probably approach this in the same way one might approach a modern disappearance. And they would look to family. They would look to, you know, connections and major stressors in their personal life. I mean, this is a guy who recently lost a loved one, may have been involved in some, was definitely involved in some sort of estate situation.
Sure, yeah. I guess we can just talk about the very first theory, which was, of course, suicide. Mm-hmm. They thought maybe he had jumped from the train on his own somewhere between Dijon and Paris. But they searched, you know, trackside that whole distance, didn't find anything, and of course, you know, why would he take his luggage with him if he did that? And not only that, it would make it even more visible if, you know, there's the body and luggage somewhere, you know, in the woods in between or something like that, you know, or if you jumped off a bridge or
right.
Knows.
Okay, so I guess I'd have two questions about that. Number one,
Sure. If
anybody thinks it's suicide, is there any physical evidence to indicate that?
No physical evidence. That's the thing. All of this is just circumstantial evidence because there's no body. There's no proof of anything. No one saw him. There's no witnesses. But you know, the theory, I think that one of the theories behind the suicide thought is that he was in a significant amount of debt when he died.
That was the other thing I was going to ask, his motive.
Yeah. So he's an inventor. He's probably borrowing, taking loans from people to, you know, get these inventions off the ground, you know, these fledgling inventions. And I have seen numbers around, and, you know, these numbers are suspect because they come from a lot of different places and you read different numbers everywhere. But they said that he was somewhere around $84,000 in debt at the time of his death. And that would have been a lot of money, and it still is a lot of money, I guess, but it would be so much more in 1890, you know, kind of an unheard of amount. And, he didn't really know the true success of his new invention. He wouldn't know exactly what that would have brought him, the windfall that would have meant. I mean, I knew he thought it was big, and of course he was trying to patent it, but I don't think he had any comprehension of the type of money that would have brought in, had that been the fact. It's not very likely that he committed suicide either, because he had a loving family. There were a lot of letters that were shared between, you know, later on that were shown between him and his wife and other members of his family. And, you know, his whole family was behind him. They were all supportive. It wasn't like, you know, he was, it wasn't like he was ostracized in some way. You know, he was definitely a tight part of this close-knit family. So the suicide theory is rather unlikely.
Huh.
For a few reasons.
All right, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AsteproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Now, I know another one of the theories, which I guess maybe we can get to next, is the one that involves some kind of industrial escapade. Should we do that next? Or
yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah, okay. That's another very popular one, right?
So I do think we want to be careful not to just blithely throw out historical murder accusations, but we wouldn't be doing this from out of nowhere. Like, other people have sort of alleged this based on just circumstances, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's all circumstantial. Everything is in this case. Again, there's nothing really concrete here to hold on to.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So the theory, if you want me to just jump right into it.
Jump right in.
All right. So the timing is so suspect in this. And we mentioned, you know, there's somebody else involved. And Thomas Edison's name gets thrown into the mix quite often when we're talking about this, that Thomas Edison actually had Louis Le Prince assassinated on that train or somewhere near that train.
Now, was this something that was alleged by anyone at the time, or was it only an accusation that was alleged, like, historically as an interpretation many years later?
I believe that the family thought initially that that's what this was all about, okay. Because – and I don't think they initially came up with this theory. I think that later we'll find out, you know, there's some other things that go on too that kind of demonize Thomas Edison a little bit in the way that the patent was eventually handled. We'll get to it. But
well, I do know I read – right. Am I wrong in saying that at some point Louis LaPrince's wife said that he had left New York because he was trying to escape being pursued by industrial spies.
Yeah. So there's some background there, a little bit. You know, there is a little bit of that intrigue that, you know, there could be something going on there that's a little more nefarious than we would like to think now. Of this person, you know, Thomas Edison.
But then again, that's like secondhand hearsay, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And a lot of this is. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, this person said this to this agency and they reported that. And, you know, it's just it gets kind of distributed or passed down and it changes a little bit along the way.
Right. And then also, like, if someone is, you know, allegedly speaking to paranoia about industrial spies following them around, like that also, I mean, you could interpret that as being a sign of some form of, you know, not conspiracy, but perhaps, you know, mental illness.
Yeah. Oh, sure. That's also possible. And we're not
– Or stress.
Know, we should say right now. I guess we haven't even said this, but Thomas Edison wouldn't have been, you know, the hitman. He wouldn't have been the guy, you know, the guy pulling the cord tight around the other guy's neck or anything. Right. It would have been a henchman, or if it was, you know, something of that nature.
You were
nature.
Thinking of From Russia with Love as well. I can't help but think of all the cinematic train-related murders.
Yeah,
murder
piano wire and all that.
Thomas Edison played by, what's his name, Quint. Robert Shaw.
Yeah, Robert Shaw.
How could
that's
I
right.
not come up with his name?
All right. So, I mean, it's fascinating the timing of when all this happens and the way that Edison then benefited from the death of Louis LaPrince via the patent.
So remind us again exactly of the timing here.
Okay. So the timing is that in I guess it would be September 16th of 1890 is when Louis LaPrince went missing. Mm. And again, Edison was simultaneously working on his own camera, but it wasn't ready yet at the time.
Right.
Very, very close. Now the
they got their patents in 1891.
Yeah, that's right. And he was supposed to have the showing or the public viewing of his device, his camera.
LaPrince was
in October of 1890. So the timing is just far too convenient for Edison. It raised a lot of eyebrows. Let's just say because he benefited in such a tremendous way from this, because his name is now tied in with. The birth of cinematography, the birth of motion pictures, really, as are Lumiere brothers who came about just a little bit later, I believe, right?
So nobody's alleged – I mean, even if there's not much to these allegations, nobody's alleged that the Lumiere brothers were involved.
No, absolutely not. No.
It's all focused on Edison.
It right. is. Yeah, that's right because
– Well, the Lumiere brothers, I think like one of the things there is that like, a lot of the interpretations are that they didn't necessarily see the long-term future of this technology themselves. So they don't seem to have the character of like, you know, viciously plotting for their takeover of the culture via this new tech that they've developed.
No, absolutely not. Their name shouldn't really come into the assassination theory at all, I don't think. I mean, we'll stick with Edison being the scapegoat on that one. And you know, it's funny, as I was reading this, you'll come across so many different versions of this and the way that this all went down. And Joe, you and I had a discussion earlier in the office about some of the stuff that's very, very misleading.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, I mean, so there is one – I was looking for good, like, you know, articles in journals, like journals that would cover the history of photography and mm-hmm. stuff like that, peer-reviewed kind of things. And there's one article that is widely cited around the internet that alleges – the discovery of a diary entry by Thomas Edison from 1890 where he essentially confesses to the murder. Do you have the exact words with you?
I do.
I want to be clear. We're going to heavily caveat this in a second.
Yeah. Okay. So supposedly – should I tell where this letter came from or do you want the exact words?
No. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So this supposedly comes from a graduate student at the University of New York named Alexis Bedford. And in 2008, it was said that he was studying chemistry and photography and was conducting research into the history of motion pictures for about a year and a half prior to this discovery. Mm-hmm. And the search leads him to what they called the inner forgotten archives of the New York Library. Okay. So that's
all right.
Mysterious already, right? It's probably a room full of dusty books and, and all that. So he's finding, you know, these journals, these notes, these pages, and, you know, that are actually the work of Thomas Edison. And he stumbles across this book that's just kind of fallen apart. It's a leather-bound book. It's very dusty and old, but it's a journal of Thomas Edison. That would be fantastic to find something like that that was, you know, at this point undiscovered, really. It was just put in on the shelf and left. In the journal, you know, of course, he jotted, and he was known to keep journals like this, where he'd jot down ideas and thoughts and sketches. Most inventors do that. All of them do, probably. But he finds the following note, and it's got the date of September 20th, 1890, which is 4 days after Le Prince went missing. And the note says exactly, "Eric called me today from Dijon. It has been done. Prince is no more. This is good news, but I flinched when he told me. Murder is not my thing. I'm an inventor, and my inventions for moving images can now move forward." That's the end of the entry.
So I have seen this cited all over in, like, blog posts and even in books. I looked up this has been cited in books as evidence of Edison's involvement in this supposed murder. I am 99.99% certain that this is a work of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean a work of fraud. I don't mean like a something that is trying to be passed off as nonfiction. I believe that this article is intentionally published as a work of fiction that has been misinterpreted as a straightforward report of a real event.
What led you to believe that?
And there are a bunch of things. I mean, number one, it's
– if this were true, this is just a straight up murder confession.
Yes.
You know, or at least conspiracy to murder.
Well, I mean, the language of it is somewhat anachronistic.
Murder is not my thing.
It is not my thing.
Very clumsily written, isn't it?
On one hand, I want to say as a work of fiction, I think this isn't that bad. It's kind of interesting. But so I tried to look up the names that are cited in this article, like of the student who discovered this and of another historian who's named in this article. I can't find evidence of these people. They don't appear to me to be real people. There's, of course, that problem. One thing that I noticed is that it says – Edison says in his confession from 1890 in his diaries that he says, "Eric called me today from Dijon." So in 1890, he received a transatlantic phone call. That is not possible. I do not think there were transatlantic phone calls in 1890.
I know when the first one was made.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It was January 7th, 1927. So 37 years after this call was supposedly made is when he claims – or this note claims that he received a phone call.
I think we've had a problem here of just mislabeling an article from a journal that should have been clearly noted as a piece of fiction but has confused a lot of people.
Right, and it could have been more clearly labeled in the print version but was then digitized.
That's possible,
incorrectly.
You said earlier as well, Robert, that you know, there have been pieces of fiction that have been passed off as scientific.
Or at least have been published in scientific journals.
Even necessarily passed off. Right.
Just like presented like, hey, like Peter Watts was the example that came up. Peter Watts, former marine biologist, turned sci-fi writer, and some of his works of short fiction have appeared in scientific journals.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But they were not presented as science. But then again, if a science can – well, imagine where if a journal were digitized I wouldn't even say incorrectly, but without like sufficient,
metadata
or branding, like you could have something that is fiction would show up and be like, oh, well, here's this murder confession that just shows up out of nowhere.
All right, it seems completely implausible, doesn't it?
Yes, I do not think this happened.
Yeah, I don't think so either. No. I don't put a whole lot of stock behind it, but. I think a lot of people do. A lot of people like the intrigue of thinking that, you know, Edison was really that bad that he would have somebody offed over an invention.
Well, he did kill Topsy the elephant.
Yeah, so he did. And horses and other animals.
He killed some dogs maybe.
Yeah. He was. He liked to experiment with electricity, didn't he?
I mean, Tom, I'm not saying I think it's impossible that Thomas Edison had something to do with this, but I definitely think that this thing about his murder confession in the diary is a work of fiction that has been misinterpreted as a real factual article. And number two, I don't know. We should be careful about making historical accusations of murder just based on circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
Because remind us again, there is no physical evidence of this whatsoever.
No,
right?
No, nothing concrete at all about it.
But there is often this tendency, I think, to want to see the past in movie form. And, you know, which is ironic given we're talking about motion pictures, we want to see it dramatized. You know, we want to think it more along the lines of The Prestige. You know,
right.
with it had a villainous Edison in it.
Right, who did send henchmen to, like, hack up Tesla's stuff.
Yeah.
It's great.
Okay, maybe it's possible, but not really that likely.
Yeah, okay. I'd go with that.
Okay, all right. So that was the second one. There's actually three, four, there are five here total if you want, because I've kind of thrown in one of my other ones. All right, so number three would be the disappearance that was ordered by the family. Now— again, pretty unlikely in this case because it was a tight-knit family. We do know that from notes that were passed between family members. Uh-huh. It was a loving, tight-knit group.
But his brother is the last one to see him alive, and there's this whole estate business, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's – yeah, exactly. So that's a possibility. The disappearance that was ordered by the family was something that was born out of the idea that LaPrince could have been a closeted homosexual, that, you know, he had a family, he had kids. However, he was carrying on these other relationships that were homosexual in nature, and the family was at the time embarrassed by this and sent him away to live somewhere else without them. You know, that he was kind of the shame of the family at this point.
And so, like, they banished him into some kind of exile because he was gay?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the thought. That's the theory. And, you know, I think that this is one of the ones that comes about much later. I think this is, like, from a 1966 French film history book.
Okay.
Where the guy, Jacques, I'll mess up the last name here, but Deland, I'll say. That's probably his name. Close to it anyway.
Uh-huh.
He suggested that his disappearance was because of his family. They disapproved of his homosexuality. So they think that he fled to Chicago where he died in 1898 naturally. And again, I know these numbers are coming out of nowhere and there's not a shred of, you know, evidence or proof that that's what happened.
Huh.
But it's just a theory. It's another theory that, and I don't know why Deland thinks that, but he does.
I mean, in much in the same way that it's possible that Edison, you know, orchestrated a murder. I mean, certainly we could imagine this being the case. I mean, it certainly lines up with, with homophobia at the during that time period. And
but I would want, well, like, what's the actual evidence? I think I've read a critique of this theory that said that there's really no evidence that he was gay.
No, there's no evidence of any of this, really.
Yeah.
None of it. I mean, and not that he lived in Chicago, not that he died in, 1898? There's no proof of that. There's really nothing to this. It's just another theory that was thrown out there, again, as late as 1966. So we're talking 76 years later after the guy is gone. It's just a theory that was posited by somebody that, you know, you could grab onto and say, like, well, it's possible.
You know, this reminds me a lot of, Jack the Ripper theories. So except more limited in scope, I guess. But, Alan Moore's whole evaluation of that is that it ultimately is this Koch snowflake scenario.
The whole, Freemason conspiracy with the surgeon to the Queen Victoria.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are so many different versions. But ultimately, like, his argument was we only know so much and we will only ever know so much. And, it's just a kind of an exercise in how many little blank spaces we can fill in.
Sure. I think actual historians of the period think that, like, that whole theory is, like, definitely wrong for Jack the Ripper, right? At least that's what I've read.
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, it's all possible, right? D.B. Cooper is another one, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that to your blue in the face. And, of course, there's always – it seems like there's – every couple of years, there's someone who's making a deathbed confession that they are D.B. Cooper or their father was D.B. Cooper.
And it's kind of safe to do that in the same way it's safe to continue, you know, to make a lot of ultimately kind of like crazy ideas because we don't know and we probably never will know.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that's exactly the scenario with this here. And
so what you're telling us is that Thomas Edison wrote the Dear Boss letter like he was the Ripper.
Yeah, that's right.
He did the Whitechapel murders because he was afraid that they would get ahead of him on some kind of knife patent.
Yeah, that's a good theory. Good theory. Yeah.
Okay.
Very likely too.
Back to this case though. what are some more of our theories?
All right. So the other one, and this is really one of the last ones that you'll hear about, but then I've got another one that I want to throw in there too.
Okay.
Fratricide, which is his brother killed him.
Oh, well, again, it comes back to his brother being the last one who saw him.
And yeah, exactly right. I mean, could it have been over money? You know, his mother's will, you know, did his brother get greedy and want to take his share as well? And that's an entirely possible scenario. I mean, the only person that saw LaPrince at the Dijon station was his brother. No one else saw him on the train. No one else really. I don't even know if there's a report of him being seen on the platform even. But his brother swears that that's the last place that he saw him. He put him on the train with his luggage, and that was it. Then he just, you know, disappears into the mist somewhere.
Well, I guess a suspicion very often does fall when somebody disappears on the last person to have seen them, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, of course, you know, Scotland Yard and the French police and even the people that were investigating for the family, they all eventually interviewed everybody that was on that train that night. Mm-hmm. There was no, sense that anything aggressive was happening, you know, next door in the cabin, or, you know, that they heard or saw anybody being thrown from the train or jumping from the train or anything unusual. There was nothing really out of place on that whole thing. It's like he was never there. And I think that's the idea, is that he really was never there.
Right.
That's
never even got on the train. Explanation, right?
Yeah, exactly. The thought behind this is that his brother had him disappear, to put it politely. One more theory.
Okay.
I'll let it go. There's other people that kind of throw this around and talk about it and in a way that doesn't make sense with a lot of what we've just told you. So that's they all have some kind of hole in the story. But there's a theory that he actually did make it to Paris and he was on the train, took his luggage off the train, but somehow wasn't seen by anybody the whole time. And, you know, had to take a cab from the train station, which the train, I think, would have arrived around 11 p.m., so very late. He was going to go to a lab or, you know, somewhere to work, maybe a mm-hmm. study or some house. And the theory is that, you know, the coach that he took from the train station to wherever he was going, the person who was driving the coach likely just, you know, knocked him over the head, stole his luggage, you know, which probably had some cameras and things in it, you know, or some devices, mm-hmm. photographic devices, and simply dumped him in the river. And that was happening, I guess, quite a bit at that time. If you go back and investigate, murders at the time, it was not all that uncommon for someone just to be kind of off quickly overnight like that, dumped in the river, never to be seen again.
Well,
or found as a supposed drowned victim. And
right.
There's kind of an interesting twist to that, too, is that in 2003, someone's going through the Paris police archives and found a photograph of a drowning victim from 1890 that looked a lot like Louis LaPrince.
Huh. Really?
Yeah. So there is a photograph of a drowning victim that does match his description, that does look like him. And that's a possibility that he did drown, or somebody, you know, offed him, made it look like a drowning, and that's when he was discovered.
Well, this whole idea, just the basic idea that maybe he did make it to Paris,
mm-hmm.
like that opens it up tremendously, because there are only so many ways to die on an express train to Paris, but there are hundreds of ways to die in metropolitan Paris.
Yeah, but how does a 6'4" man, blend in and not even make his appearance, you know, known on any of the cabins? You know, if it's a full train, I don't know.
Yeah. But, why do they think he didn't arrive in Paris? Like, who would have seen him there?
Well, he was, he was scheduled to go there to meet with friends, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then a return trip to England. So maybe people were supposed to meet him in Paris and didn't. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he was supposed to meet them after, you know, I mean, I guess picking up a friend at 11 o'clock at the train station, that's kind of like it is now, you know, picking up a friend at 11 o'clock at the airport.
Yeah.
It's not a great favor to ask of somebody, you know, but sometimes you have to. But maybe they didn't. Maybe they said you can catch a cab. You know, meet me at this hotel in the morning or something like that. I'm this is all, again, just theory. I don't really know the surrounding story about what was supposed to happen in Paris when he made it there.
Right.
But yeah, maybe he did make it. Maybe he didn't. We don't know. But he's the theory, again, the predominant theory is that he went missing somewhere between Dijon and Paris. He never really made it there. But there's a lot of different, you know, ideas tossed about. And I'm sure you can come up with five more, you know, scenarios that might make sense. But the timing is just all very, very strange because,
yeah.
Again, this whole thing comes back to this patent that never really happened. But then Edison kind of swooped in and took the patent. The family, I guess, you would think the family could patent his devices. I read somewhere that there is like a 7-year waiting period between when somebody goes missing and you can – I don't know if this is a U.S. patent law or what, but you're not able to patent the family member's item until after the person is officially declared dead. And I think he was declared dead in 1897, so that was 7 years later.
Hmm.
But in that time – in that window of time, that's when Edison came in with his new camera and patented that device and of course, made a fortune on the royalties. So just interesting timing with all this. And of course, that's sparked many patent wars. We know there are patent wars that were happening at the time over many, many different things. I mean, the Wright brothers, they fought patent wars for about 11 years. And the same thing with Alexander Graham Bell and the telephone. That took something like 11 years and like 600 lawsuits, I think.
Wow.
Over the telephone.
There was a huge patent fight just over celluloid film because it was apparently first developed in a sort of vague way with a kind of poorly worded patent by an Episcopalian minister from New Jersey named Hannibal Goodwin.
I think that's right. Hannibal's right.
Yeah, I just looked it up. That's right. Hannibal Goodwin. But then also that he was in competition with the patent on celluloid film that belonged to the Eastman Company. And so they fought over that. Of course, Eastman was producing, celluloid film at bulk, like enough to sell it to Edison. And Goodwin was not.
This still happens today. I mean, Sony and Kodak were in a patent war that lasted until 2007. Over digital cameras.
Oh wow!
So it's newer technology, but they're still fighting these same type of wars. It happened with radio. It happened with cars, airplanes. Name any big invention, light bulbs. It all went through the courts in some way, many, many different times, and there was always a battle over who invented it first and who has the rights to it,
right.
And who gets the money from it.
Right? And then come the patent trolls. That's another layer of complexity.
That's right. Yeah, there are people that are patent trolls. That's right, who just kind of scoop up the patents from other people that are more that are completely deserving of that patent,
mm-hmm.
And they take, of course, the credit for it. And I guess maybe Edison would he count as possibly a patent troll? I mean, he had a different scenario. We talked about his labs and how he had. Lots of inventors working under his umbrella of the Edison Labs, and that was something different maybe. But he's
– Well, I do think Edison was not above pouncing on somebody else's idea if he thought he could get there first.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't know if you would think that this would all kind of play out smoothly in the courts, and it certainly didn't. I mean, it wasn't as cut and dry as you might think. LePrince's son, his name is Adolf,
mm-hmm.
He – appeared in court, I guess, as a witness for the defense in a case that was brought by Thomas Edison against a company called the American Mutoscope and Biograph Company. The interesting thing about that is that company was founded in 1895 by William Kennedy Dixon, who was the guy that worked under Edison at his lab to create the camera. He developed the camera. He's the one who really did all the photographic work on it, I guess, the lenses and, the film and all that, the technology that made that work, really.
Yes.
So he's the founder of that company. So Edison is suing him. But Adolf LePrince, his son again, comes in 1898 and testifies as a witness for the defense in this court case. And he claims in that court case that LePrince was the first and only inventor of cinematography. So he kind of throws in this bombshell into the proceedings. And he says, of course, because of that, my family, my dad had been, his dad had been declared dead the year prior, is then they should be receiving the royalties for this award for this this device and of course the patent that goes along with it, the whole process, right? Well, he was unable to submit his dad's cameras as evidence in that court case. For some reason, the judge said, "No, you can't show me these cameras." He wasn't able to put it into the case as evidence, and so the court ruled in favor of Edison in that particular case. But a couple of years later, they overturned that, and the direction was reversed, or the decision was reversed rather. But this is another interesting twist in the story: is that Adolf. He's a young man at this time. He's 29 years old, 3 years later. It was in 1901. So he's 29. He's out hunting, duck hunting, near his family cottage, which is on Fire Island in New York State. Mm-hmm. And he ends up being shot to death. And I don't know if he was hunting alone, if he's hunting with somebody. You would think that all this would have been a little bit more, public knowledge, what happened. But the recording of this is that he was just simply found dead after he was out duck hunting with his own rifle at his side. They don't know if it was suicide, if it was an accident. Of course, it could have been either one of those, right? But the mother, the widow now, LaPrince, the mother of Adolf, says that she thinks that it's a second murder, that, the kid simply knew too much. And because he had testified in court, everybody else knew what he knew now. And that was the reason for another murder. So there's another murder mystery at the end of that one. That's never really been solved either, is that, the son turns up dead at a young age. Just 2 years later, 3 years later.
So obviously the Edison villainists are, they think he was involved in that too.
Well, that's another theory. Yeah, that's a possibility of what happened.
But then on the same hand, you can see why murder does not need to actually be involved for one to, especially with this family, to have, some degree of hatred or, distrust of Edison.
Of course.
And therefore, it's not that much more of a leap then, given, especially if you're distraught over, yet another untimely death / disappearance in the family, to, jump to this this next level of accusation.
Oh, for sure. And they're going to point to the villain that they already know.
Yeah, he's already established as the villain of the piece, the villain of the family. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, I think this is just a fascinating part of history and something that I never expected to come across when we're talking about, motion picture cameras.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strange how, that the story just, it captivated me right from the beginning, but it's strange the twists and turns that this story takes.
All right. Time to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back.
So on the disappearance of Le Prince, if you're someone who I think you've got a good sense for crime and cold cases and all that, if you had to go with your gut feeling, what do you think you'd say is most likely to you? What feels most right to you?
What feels most right to me is that his brother killed him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Having to do with the inheritance, or
I do, and I think that it's I think because of money is just such a strong factor in a lot of these cases, and especially when you're talking about among family members where they're supposedly tight, but money does come between people like that, and it's unfortunate, but it happens, and maybe he didn't have the foresight to know that his brother would have been so much better off. He wouldn't have been a burden. I don't know how better to put that. Maybe I'm saying that wrong, that he wasn't really a burden. It's just that he stood to make twice the amount of money from the inheritance as he would if his brother was still around. He could take his share, and it's just downright greed.
Yeah.
I mean,
but ultimately, again, this is just a circumstantial hunch, right?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, any of these theories are possible, not very likely, some of them. But I think that the fratricide is probably the one that is closest to, correct, I think.
Yeah.
So what about either of you? Any gut feelings on what it might be?
I mean, on one level, we talked about Mybridge, who definitely murdered somebody.
There's no question about that.
So the idea that there might be a murder in photographic motion picture history, I'm already on board with that reality. I like your argument though. I mean, when you come down to what are the reasons that homicides are committed? Generally it's going to be some sort of, a family connection or, somebody the victim knew, not some shadowy organization that was plotting against them.
Sure.
So it seems like that, and also it removes the whole mystery of how do they disappear on the train? And if he jumped to his death, why did he take his luggage with him? And then why was that body and or that luggage never found? So, I like your argument on this.
Okay. All right, fair enough. What about you, Joel?
I don't know. I'm not good at things like this. I think sometimes of what people say, and I know I don't want to malign you guys because I asked the question, but I think of what one time somebody asked Carl Sagan, do you think there are aliens out there or something like that? And he said, I don't know. And they said, well, what's your gut feeling? And he said, I try not to think with my gut.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I may have gut feelings, but I feel like maybe it's better not to say them. I guess I probably have a gut feeling that agrees with you. Maybe I tend to think, it when people are pointing outside of the inner circle, it very often is something inside the inner circle. Then again, a random crime could have possibly explained it. I'm not very convinced by the Edison thing.
Yeah. I think like the Parisian argument. Yeah, that also is kind of convincing, the idea that all right, maybe he made it to Paris. And they're just – people didn't notice him on the train. And then once he gets to Paris, there's any number of ways that he could have met his untimely demise.
A robbery murder, which then resulted in the corpse that they found in the river that – see, that's – I don't know why he wouldn't have been discovered at that point. Why they would I think wouldn't they even publish photos of people that were drowning victims so that the unidentified bodies so that people – or they could place them on view in some of the morgues there in town, I know, because drowning was such a common thing, and these unknowns, they wanted to figure out who they were and where they came from, at least get them a proper burial, allow their family to take the remains and do with them what they want. But I don't know, it just seems like it's a very possible scenario that he did make it to Paris, and he did get offed by some cab driver.
It's like the least cinematic theory too, which I feel like is often like a way to try and judge the past. Like which is the least interesting story? Yeah. Then you know there's a chance that that's the way to go.
Oh sure, yeah.
That's a very good point. If it makes a good story, you should be inherently skeptical.
All right, but I mean the bottom line is we don't know. We probably will never know. You know, obviously listeners out there, you may have some theories. You want to chime in. You want to share your solution to this mystery.
Well, here's one thing I will say. If you're one of those people who likes to stick it to Edison, and I can sympathize, I understand sticking it to Edison, you don't have to resort to saying, I think he's a murderer based on no physical evidence whatsoever, or, you know, or referring to like a fictional story about a diary entry. But you can say he didn't get there first. In fact, he didn't get there first in multiple ways. Like LaPrince had the movie camera before Edison, definitely. And even Edison's own kinetograph and kinetoscope, you know, it looks like the heavy lifting was done by Dixon, not by Edison.
Yeah, at this point, we're just arguing over when the patent was filed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all it really comes down to. And that you know, then begets the money, right? I mean, that's the whole goal behind all of this really for them was that, you know, I think maybe LaPrince had more of an altruistic view of this that, you know, he just simply wanted to make it better, make photography better by you know, bringing motion to the screen in front of people. And maybe Edison, I think, was more money driven.
Yeah.
I think that's the way it comes down.
And fame and credit driven.
Yeah, exactly right. And of course, that would have been great if that had come for LaPrince as well, but it never did.
Well, maybe it will now.
Maybe. Posthumously, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wonder how much of his family still exists. You know, are there any princes out there still that might benefit from something like that? Or how would they even benefit from something like that?
Every film now made must give 50% of profits to his family.
Yeah, they could charge per minute, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Some exorbitant cost, I'm sure. Yeah.
All right, well, Scott. Well, thanks for coming on the show here to chat a little murder mystery with us.
Yeah, well, I hope I didn't leave you with more questions than answers.
But that's not your fault. that's what history does.
Yeah, I guess so. We're at least kind of reopening the books on this one and letting people know what happened. And I don't know. I like when you can kind of spark someone's interest in something and get them to search on their own and maybe kind of – you know, figure out alternate theories or, you know, chime in with what they think may have happened. That's always fun for me.
Yeah, and certainly everybody loves a good murder mystery. So if this has helped make the history of the motion picture more engaging for podcast listeners, then I'm in favor of it.
Oh, great. I hope it has. I hope it has. And thank you again for inviting me here. I really appreciate the offer, and I'd love to sit in with you anytime.
Absolutely.
Oh, thanks so much for coming, Scott.
It's been fun.
All right. Well, there you have it. Thanks once more to Scott Benjamin for taking time out of his day, out of his research to join us on the show to discuss a little invention and indeed a little potential murder.
Potential murder, potential suicide, potential runaway and hide in Chicago, potential – were there any others? Do we have like a beast morph situation?
There was potential hidden away by the family. We didn't even get into like any just crazy speculation. We didn't get into aliens.
Yeah, no abductions. Randolph became Sasquatch.
Or Langoliers. I mean, is it possible for Langoliers on a train? You don't need an aviation technology for that to happen. I don't know. at any rate, we covered the realistic ideas.
That was a Jules Verne novelette.
Yeah, Langoliers on a train. All right. Thanks again to Scott coming on the show. I think does this wrap it up for motion pictures, or are there going to be more motion picture episodes?
I think we got one more motion picture episode in us.
All right. Well, stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for future inventions. We have some non-photographic cinematography episodes coming up that are in the works.
We've been on the photographic history train, and who knows if we'll ever get off.
Yes, if we'll reach the destination. We will reach the destination. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other episodes of Invention, check out what the show's all about, head on over to InventionPod.com. That's the website. That's where you'll find all these episodes. But you can also find us anywhere you find a podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, go there. Find us, subscribe to us, rate and review the show, give us a whole bunch of stars, say nice things about us. That's the best thing you can do to support the show and help us moving forward.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. We've already thanked Scott a bunch of times on this one. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.